All right, even though we aren't discussing the exam in here, I'll say a couple things about it. One is that it's right about where it usually is, score-wise. Not only the mean, but also the range. Usually a pretty wide range. And one reason there's a pretty wide range is because there's a pretty wide range of student types that take this course. It's not all biology majors. But the fact that there's a couple perfect scores shows you that it is possible. By the way, if you haven't already picked up your answer form, make sure you do that before you leave. The other thing I wanted to say is that it's astounding how big a fraction of the class did not follow instructions on writing your names on the back. Not only ignored the instructions on the screen, then when I made a vocal announcement to the entire class, you ignored that as well. So, and that's not such a big deal other than the fact that it makes me have to write your name on the back. The bigger deal is that if you are dissatisfied with your score, one reason might be that you're not paying close enough attention to instructions. Reading these things carefully is important to the process of doing well, actually, because I write them very carefully. Anyway, we'll talk about those in lab time. So it's time to start a new unit. And this is really the beginning of the regular part of the course, which will be the rest of the course. And by that I mean that from now on, we're instead of this introductory material, we're going to survey the body one organ system at a time. For the rest of 201 and for all of 202, we'll study an organ system at a time. And so we're going to get through some of the organ systems in this course, and then 202 will treat the ones that we just don't get to in this course. That does actually bring up one other thing about the test, and that is that this is usually the highest mean of all the tests. Test number 3 is usually the lowest mean, so you have that to coming up in 2 units. There's usually kind of a decline from 1 to 3, and then it stays. It might come up a little bit after 3 and stays somewhere around usually mid to upper 60% mean. But it largely depends on the class. That's not engraved in stone or anything. The reason, by the way, that 3 is probably the lowest, usually, is that it's really in 201 the biggest dose of physiology that we get. The course is called Anatomy and Physiology. 202 has more physiology than 201. In 201, although we do talk about physiology, really the biggest dose of it that you get is how the nervous system and muscular system work together to have muscles contract. And that throws a lot of people, which is why that's usually the lowest mean. I just wanted to let you know that if you are really dissatisfied in this first score, you should expect it to get only harder, so make sure that you make the necessary adjustment. All right, we can go on now to the first official organ system that we're going to study, which is the integumentary system. So named because integument means covering. And so the integumentary system is the organ system that covers the rest of the body. Of course, the integumentary system is part of the body itself, but it forms the outer covering. And so before we get to the details of slide 1, let's just talk about the system itself in overview. For one thing, the components, the major components of the integumentary system are the skin, of course, and what are called accessory structures. So skin and accessory structures are the components. Those accessory structures, by the way, include such things as hair, nails, and glands of different kinds that we'll be talking about. So all of those combined make up the integumentary system. And if we look at, before we look at the details, let's talk about the functions, major functions of the integumentary. Any given organ system, of course, is a collection of organs that function more or less for some common goal, right? Digestive system organs work together for digestion and absorption and so on. So the integumentary system is no different from any other organ system in that respect. It forms a covering, but what is the function of a covering? Well, there's multiple functions, as you might expect. One is that it simply forms a barrier between you and the rest of the universe. So there is a protective barrier, protective in the sense that it protects you from invasion of microorganisms that would easily kill you if it weren't for your skin. If they were able to get into your body, which they are able to anyway, despite the skin, infection ensues and that can easily kill you. So there's protection against invasion, but there's also protection against physical trauma, mechanical damage. Your integumentary system is the most abused of all your organ systems because it has direct contact with the rest of the world. So things are always rubbing up against it, poking at it, things like this. And thankfully, the integumentary system responds to this abuse by being the fastest of all organ systems to heal itself, basically. So you damage your integument just through the course of living. Not, you know, you don't have to have a huge open wound for it to be damaging. Just normally using your skin is damaging enough. And it responds by replenishing itself. So this kind of protection is not protection from disease, which microorganisms would cause. It's protection just from physical trauma that the underlying tissues and organs, you know, your skeletal muscles and things even deeper than that, would just be damaged much more easily if it weren't for the skin and associated structures. There's also a very important function for thermostasis. Thermostasis is just one aspect of homeostasis. It specifically is maintenance of a relatively stable body temperature. We've already discussed that it's really, body temperature is almost never exactly at what the brain wants it to be, at set point, in other words. But we're homeotherms, which means we don't let it get out of a pretty narrow range that is centered on that set point. And various organ systems help out in this process, but the integumentary system is important in this thermostasis function because it is a surface, and heat exchange between a body and its surroundings takes place at the interface between that object and its surroundings, which is its surface. So since the integumentary system makes up our surface, that's where we are going to gain or lose heat, depending on the situation. There's different modes of heat transfer that can occur. Conduction is heat transfer between two bodies that are in direct contact with each other. You know, for instance, if you try to keep your hand on that hot stove, well, first of all, your nervous system won't really let you do that. But if you do it longer than you should, you're going to gain heat conductively because you're in direct contact with it. There can also be heat transfer convectively. Now, convection refers to bulk movement of a fluid. What is a fluid, by the way? What is the definition of a fluid? Well, it's a noun that actually is also an adjective. Fluid can be used as an adjective, right? When it's used as an adjective, what does it mean? It means flowing, right? Doesn't count if you don't say it loud enough. It's totally unimpressive. Yeah, fluid just means flowing or able to flow. So a fluid is either a liquid or a gas. Those are the two states of matter that flow. Well, wind is a good example of convection because it's bulk movement of a fluid. We have convection occurring in our bodies, though, because we have a circulatory system. And the blood is a fluid that gets convected, moved in mass, rather than just based on diffusion. Whole mass of molecules get moved in convection. And the heart is what does that. The heart pumps the blood around. That convects the blood. Blood carries a whole lot of things, and we'll talk about blood in 202, the things that it does carry. But one thing that it carries, since blood is material, is heat. All right, anything that's made up of atoms has heat. Heat is the energy of the motion of the particles, thermal energy. Well, metabolism, which, remember, is the set of chemical reactions occurring in your cells, it is your life. Like any other thermodynamic process, is inefficient to some degree, which means that it produces some waste heat. A lot of the energy that is stored in the food that you eat just gets released as heat rather than being put to use usefully in the cell. So heat builds up, and it builds up in the core of the body, away from the surface. The blood can conductively pick up that heat, because heat, just like particles, can diffuse down a gradient. So if you have a warmer surface and a cooler surface put together, heat is going to diffuse from the warmer surface to the cooler surface. So if cool blood gets pumped to the core where it's warmer, that blood will pick up heat from the body, from the non-blood part of the body, and convect that heat via circulation eventually to the skin. And how much that occurs depends on what's happening at the skin surface. You know, you have a whole system of blood vessels, but it's never the case that all of them are open at one time. That's what we call shock, right? That would kill you. It would be like everyone in the city flushing the toilet at once or opening all the faucets at once. There wouldn't be enough pressure to serve that need at the moment. So blood vessels are shut down and opened up depending on what's happening in the body. Well, if the body is too warm, then we can open up more vessels to the skin surface, and therefore blood, which has picked up heat conductively in the core, is now convecting that heat to the skin, where it's going to conductively travel from the blood to the cooler skin and then out the surface of the body, and you're going to lose heat that way. On the other hand, if it's the opposite problem and you want to save that heat because your body temperature is below set point, you can shut down temporarily vessels to the skin. Of course, it won't be permanent because the skin has to survive. You have to give blood to the skin every once in a while. But you can close it down as much as possible and therefore not have as much heat dumped at the surface. You want to keep that blood circulating that heat circulating via the blood within the body to use that so-called waste heat to your advantage in that case, to let it build up because you want the body temperature to be warmer. So conduction and convection are both modes of heat transfer. So is evaporation. And the integumentary system is very important for evaporative cooling as well. Especially for mammals, but not only for mammals. Now, you've probably already guessed that I'm talking about sweating. Sweat glands are part of the integumentary system, and we sweat so that the evaporation of the water from that sweat will cool us. We're not the only animals that do this. We're the only ones that have sweat glands, but birds, for instance, and other reptiles are able to evaporate water from their skin directly, even though they don't have dedicated sweat glands producing sweat. It's just water leaking through the skin, basically. Anyway, that's truly important around here. You know, if you ride a bicycle, very short distance even, in the summer, say July, it might seem like you're not really sweating, especially if you're not really exerting yourself. You're just trying to get to a convenience store or something and not pedal vigorously so that you're trying to minimize your sweating. It'll feel, as long as you're riding, it'll feel like you're not sweating very much. But then as soon as you get there, your whole skin just gets soaked. It seems like you just started sweating. Well, you actually have been sweating that rate the whole time you're biking. It's just that the wind produced by the relative wind produced by you moving through the air is helping the evaporation take place. So you're evaporating that whole time, just not feeling the sweat. When you're sweating at a rate that exceeds the rate of evaporation, then it builds up as liquid and you feel that. It's a good thing, though, because you probably would already die before you get to the convenience store if you weren't sweating on the way. Evaporation is really an efficient way of shedding heat. I'll talk more about evaporation later in the chapter, but those are all involved in thermostasis. The skin also has important functions, or I should say the whole integumentary system, not just the skin, in human expression, particularly the face. So you know that you, through experience, that you can tell a lot about what people are thinking based on the actual shape of their face at the moment, which does not stay the same, right? Eyebrows move, things like that. They're very subtle, and we learn them, different shapes mean, but that wouldn't be possible without muscles pulling on different parts of the skin, moving things around. You know, smiling, frowning, things like that, that's all really a function of the integumentary system. And what haven't I mentioned? Another important one is production of vitamin D, which is an unusual one because vitamins get their name because they're vital. We have to have them. But most vitamins are classified as vitamins because it's some chemical that the body absolutely requires but is incapable of making on its own. You know, there's a lot of things that we absolutely require, but a lot of those things we can make at the molecular level out of other stuff. In most cases, vitamins we can't make, and therefore we have to have that material coming in through our diet, because bacteria, for instance, are able to make it. They're able to basically do everything for themselves, and we rely on them for a lot of things, including vitamins. But in the case of vitamin D, it actually, even though it is classified as a vitamin, and we definitely do need it, we can make our own vitamin D. And that involves the skin, but it also involves the liver and the kidneys. So what happens at the skin surface is that in response to ultraviolet radiation, which is coming from sunlight, or which is part of sunlight, that allows a chemical transformation at the skin cells, turns cholesterol, which is vital in your body for several different reasons, it turns cholesterol into a chemical called cholecalciferol. That cholecalciferol molecule then travels to the liver, which sticks on a hydroxyl group and transforms cholecalciferol into calcidiol. Calcidiol then travels to the kidneys, and the kidneys hook on another hydroxyl group and transforming it into calcitriol. Calcitriol is the active form of vitamin D. Vitamin D then travels to the small intestine, calcitriol that is, travels to the small intestine, where it does its major job, which is to greatly increase the efficiency of absorption of calcium. So calcium is another thing that's absolutely required in our bodies, and we get it from our diet, but unlike other nutrients, calcium doesn't make its way through the epithelial lining of the gut, the small intestine, very easily on its own. So it needs the help of vitamin D to do that. After we go through this three-step phase of making our own vitamin D, then our gut will be able to absorb much more calcium. Yeah. You mean compared to other states?
Yeah.
I didn't know that there was, actually. That's statistically true, though?
Yeah.
Well, I believe you. I don't know why it would be this state in particular, because you would think it would be just the opposite.
Yeah.
This brings up, though, the notion of it being a trade-off, because ultraviolet light is required for for vitamin D production. But it's also, of course, bad in large doses, right? It also causes skin cancer, which is another function of the skin, by the way, protection from ultraviolet radiation. If that UV were able to get to the underlying structures that skin covers, that would be bad news for those cells, and there would be a lot more cancer. Skin has a way of dealing with some of the UV, but anything over a certain limit, it's going to drastically increase the likelihood of developing a skin cancer. So we want enough sunlight to produce our own vitamin D, but not so much that we get cancer. And I just don't know why. Your question?
It's because it's so hot, we don't go out.
Yeah. It is true that those months are the indoor months around here. But still, we still definitely get exposed more than high latitudes. I'm not sure, other than behavioral. I mean, it might be because we're slathering on so much UV protection because we're scared of the cancer. By the way, that's prudent because UV definitely will cause cancer, and there's other ways of getting vitamin D. You don't have to rely on your body to make it. That's the point, right? You can take a vitamin D supplement just like any other vitamin supplement, or you can just get plenty from your diet. But in the case of vitamin D, unlike most other vitamins, you are able to actually make your own. Anyone else have a question, or did I just see some movement? Okay. Let's talk about the particulars of slide one now. This is just a kind of a representative slice of skin. Actually, it's more than skin. I shouldn't say it that way. It's a slice of integument, really. But it's a layered structure. And on the right-hand side of this slab, notice that there are three major layers listed with brackets. Working superficial to deep, those are epidermis, dermis, and hypodermis. Now, what does dermis mean? In a voice loud enough to count. Yes, it means skin. So that's kind of confusing, because epidermis, which means on the skin, is really not named very well, because the epidermis is part of the skin. So is the dermis, which means skin, but the skin is more than just dermis. These two, though, epidermis and dermis together, make up officially the skin. Hypodermis is part of the integumentary system, but it's not actually skin. And it literally means below the skin, right? Below meaning here, deeper. Now, these are not just ways of having more terms to learn. They're fundamentally different from each other at the tissue level. Epidermis is what kind of tissue? It's epithelial tissue, correct. And therefore, it's chock full of cells, right? Epithelial tissue has cellularity, not very much extracellular matrix at all. So just cells right up against each other. And we'll talk about different kinds of cells in a little bit. The dermis, on the other hand, is what kind of tissue? It is connective tissue, largely, mostly connective tissue. And therefore, there is considerable extracellular matrix, and there's a scattering of cells throughout the dermis. Now, when we were talking about tissues, and I was talking about different properties of epithelial tissue in general, did I say avascularity? I don't remember whether I did or not. Along with cellularity and regeneration, avascularity means what? Well, what does vascular mean? It means having to do with a vessel, right? And A means not. So avascularity means absence of vessels. And epithelial tissue has avascularity. You notice that you don't see any blood vessels in the actual epidermis. But you do have blood vessels in the most superficial part of the dermis, which is still deep to the epidermis. But the most superficial part, right where the dermis comes into contact with the epidermis, you have blood vessels. And this is important because if you're going to have cells that are alive and remain alive, then those cells better not be very far from the blood supply. Living cells in general in the body are never more than a few cells width from a capillary, a blood capillary. So they're all either in direct contact with a capillary and therefore can get stuff that the blood is carrying to them and get rid of stuff that they're going to dump into the blood, either directly or by diffusion a short distance away. Right, that's how this exchange takes place, diffusively. And diffusion, remember, occurs reliably well only over very short distances. So you have to be close to a blood supply if you're a living cell. And the epidermis is made of many cells in several layers, but not all of them are alive. The living cells of the epidermis are the ones situated basally, close to that interface between epidermis and dermis. That's where they're all born, in a sense, as well. That's where they're created by mitosis. And then they migrate and mature. As they migrate superficially toward the top of this figure, they'll replace cells from the actual surface that gets abraded, that you can touch, the top outer layer of the epidermis. Those cells get removed continuously, but there's ones coming behind them, continuously replacing them. But as they do that migration from the base to the apex of the epithelium, they're going to eventually get far enough away from the blood supply that they can't survive. And so they die. And that's why the cells that you can actually touch when you touch your surface are already dead. Those are dead epidermal cells. The living ones are deep to that. And even though the blood vessels do not actually enter the epithelium itself, they come close enough to it at the dermal-epidermal interface that diffusion can still occur over those short distances. Notice also that that interface is not just a smooth interface. It's kind of like packing material, that egg crate packing material. So there's a lot of undulations between epidermis and dermis. And if we were to peel the whole epidermis off, we would be left with what looked like a bunch of little finger-like projections or bumps on the dermal surface. And those are called dermal papillae. plural of papilla. Papilla is kind of a general word that means a bump or finger-like projection. And so in each dermal papilla, which is then covered by epidermis, there is a little network of tiny blood vessels that do the job of serving the cells in the epidermis that are right around that dermal papilla. Okay, so that's the skin officially, epidermis and dermis. Hypodermis is packing material, more or less, deep to the skin, and it, notice, is made up mostly of adipocytes, or fat cells. We've talked about the utility of fat before. What are the uses of fat? Store energy, insulation, which is really, the storage of energy is not really an integumentary system function other than the fact that it's part of the integument is storing that energy. But it's really not about being a covering in that case. But the thermal insulation is an important one. So different parts of the body will have different amounts of this subcutaneous fat layer that we call the hypodermis. Cutaneous, by the way, is another word that means of the skin. So subcutaneous means below the skin. There are parts of the skin, though, that have effectively no hypodermis, no fat beneath it, like the scalp, for instance. Other places can have considerable amounts, especially in the belly, because that's where it is chiefly deposited when you're taking in more energy in the form of food than you use metabolically. But there's another function of fat, and that is padding, right? So this helps the skin out, helps the integumentary system out in its function for being protective of the other stuff that it's covering. There's padding in certain areas, making it even less likely that if something comes along and hits the skin, it's not going to damage the underlying structures because the fat is a cushion. So there's rich vascularity in the hypodermis, and there's vessels running here and there through the dermis, but then it's a richer supply right at the superficial part of the dermis at these dermal papillae. Now, the whole system includes more than the skin, though, right? It includes accessory structures. And we see some of them here. We don't see any nails here, but you know where your nails are on your digits, right? You have toenails and fingernails. They are pretty tough devices, and hair is too. Skin itself, compared to other cells, is pretty tough. The epidermis, that's what I'm talking about actually, not the whole skin. The epidermal cells get their toughness after they've developed enough because of the presence of an important protein called keratin. So the skin cells are said to be keratinized cells because they have produced keratin and become tough in the process. All keratin is pretty tough stuff, but there's two varieties of it, soft keratin and hard keratin. It's kind of the same stuff, but hard keratin is manufactured in a way that there's a bunch of cross-links between the molecules, so it makes the overall complex much stronger than just soft keratin. Soft keratin makes skin cells tough, epidermal cells. Hard keratin makes hair and nails even tougher. So the nails are particularly horny, tough structures because of hard keratin, and similarly for hair. Beyond the hair and nails, though, we have glands. And depending on where the body is, there are different types of glands. In nearly all parts of the skin, we have sweat glands of at least one variety, which are called mirocrine sweat glands. See those right here? And a mirocrine sweat gland is operating as a miracrine gland that we've already talked about, right? So that's what is the process that a miracrine gland uses to secrete its whatever its product is? Be proud. Yeah, exocytosis. Yeah, all miracrine glands undergo exocytosis to produce their secretory product. And these miracrine sweat glands are properly named because they definitely are miracrine in function. But notice that they have their duct emptied directly onto the skin surface through a sweat pore. But there are also glands called, unfortunately, apocrine sweat glands that are not actually operating in an apocrine function despite their name. So they're not really just budding off little pieces of themselves, which is what would make them officially apocrine. They also are undergoing exocytosis. But for some reason, we continue, even though we know that's not true anymore, to call them apocrine sweat glands. And notice that their ducts empty into a hair follicle. So their secretory product, which could be called apocrine sweat, is delivered onto a hair surface. Okay? Now, even though there's these two different kinds of sweat, they have totally different functions. Apocrine sweat glands are found only in a few places on the body. The axillae, which are the armpits, groin region, have apocrine sweat glands. The rest of the skin does not. It has just miracrine sweat glands. Miracrine sweat is very watery, and it's produced for the purpose of evaporatively cooling the body. Did I say miracrine just then or apocrine? Okay, good. That was right. Apocrine sweat glands, on the other hand, produce a secretory product that is rich in lipid. And this secretion, not miracrine sweat, but apocrine sweat, is the stuff that eventually stinks. So this is what body odor is caused by, apocrine sweat glands, not miracrine sweat glands. But apocrine sweat glands product is not itself what stinks. So if you were to take some apocrine sweat and sample it immediately upon production, it would have no odor. So that's not what we smell when we smell body odor. The places where it's released, though, are usually places where it can build up and therefore start being eaten by the billions of bacteria that live on your skin surface. Tens of billions of bacteria live on your skin surface, not just in those places, all over the surface. But anyway, they feed on these lipids, and as part of their metabolic process, they release waste products that are what we actually smell. So it's not until the apocrine sweat is processed by bacteria that we actually can detect it olfactorily. This is also, though, why you selectively apply antiperspirant. Now, you don't put antiperspirant over your entire skin because those miracrine sweat glands aren't producing anything that's going to stink. Anyway, those are accessory structures because they're glands. And we also have glands in the ear canal producing a specialized secretory product called cerumen. Cerumen is just the anatomical name for earwax. So that's the only place we find those glands, but they're part of the integumentary system as well. Also scattered here and there, we have various kinds of receptors. And I'm talking specifically about sensory receptors. So not receptors like we've used the term before. These aren't molecules that bind to ligands if they come along as signals. These are sensory receptors that respond to some sort of mechanical stimulus. And so this is another major function of the skin, by the way, that I didn't mention along with the others. It's involved in sensing changes in the environment. Okay? Now, sense and sensation are two different things, by the way. Sense just refers to incoming information, information coming into the central nervous system. And so the skin is involved in that because it houses various kinds of receptors that create action potentials in nearby neurons. Those action potentials are the sensory information that's delivered to the central nervous system. Sensation is high-level processing to the point that we actually create an experience. Right? For instance, like vision. The light coming into the eyeballs is sensed. That information, that sensory information is sent to the brain, but the high-level processing in the brain is what actually creates the image, which is not a real thing. It's just an experience that we undergo. Similarly, we experience being touched various ways. And so the integumentary system is important for that incoming information because it houses various kinds of sensory receptors, including things like, and we'll talk more about these in the nervous system chapter, but you have, for instance, tactile corpuscles up there in the upper left. You have a Pacinian or lamellar corpuscle right here. There are other kind of sensory receptors that we'll talk about that are embedded somewhere in the skin. But the skin is not only the largest organ, period, in the body. It's also by far the largest sensory organ. Because we have other sensory organs that are much more specialized and highly localized. Those are our so-called special senses. And the organs are eyes, ears, nose, tongue. But the skin overall is a huge sensory organ as well. Let me go on to the next slide. Not all of them will take nearly this long. Slide 2. Here we're looking at just part of the skin. This is the epidermis. Well, you see a little bit of the dermis below it. And this is a good view of those dermal papillae that I was talking about right at the interface between dermis and epidermis. But notice along the left side of the slide that we can see that the epidermis itself, which is one layer of two in the skin, the epidermis itself is layered. So the overall epidermis is one of two major layers that the skin has, but then you can subdivide that one epidermal layer into several strata, which is the plural of stratum. And stratum is just another word that means layer. So when we say that something is stratified, that means it occurs in layers. Now, what we're looking at here is, well, before I forget, let me say that skin overall, those two layers, dermis and epidermis, in terms of thickness, and you saw this in the previous slide, is mostly dermis. The dermis makes up the majority of the thickness. Okay? The epidermis, though, depending on where it is on the body, includes a different number of layers. And we therefore make a distinction between so-called thick skin and so-called thin skin. Most of your skin, most of your epidermis, is thin skin. But on the palms and the corresponding portion of your fingers, which would be in the anatomical position, the anterior parts of your fingers, right? Not the backs of them where your knuckles are, right here. All this surface is thick skin. Same with the feet. The plantar portion of your feet, which is the sole, and the corresponding parts of the toes, that's all thick skin. Everywhere else is thin skin. Now, what we're looking at here is an example of thick skin because it has all five strata. Thin skin has only four of these strata. And the one that thin skin does not have is the one that's listed second down from the top. Stratum lucidum does not occur in thin skin, but all the others do. So that's one difference between thin and thick skin. The other, though, is that in thick skin, in each of the strata that it shares with thin skin, the thick skin variety will have a greater number of cells in that stratum. So each stratum is really itself layered because there's multiple layers of cells within just one stratum. And in thick skin, each stratum will be a greater number of cells thick. So the overall epidermis in thick skin is much thicker, usually about five times as thick as thin skin. And so this is placed in the parts of the body that really take the most abuse, right? Hands and feet. Okay, to think about these, though, meaningfully, I think it's best to work from bottom to top because, as I mentioned earlier, that's the progression that cells themselves take as they mature and migrate through the strata. So well, there's a variety of cell types that we're looking at here, but the vast majority of them, the ones that are all purplish colored here, are called keratinocytes, which literally means a keratin cell, right? So these are ones that, like I said, produce bundles of soft keratin to give them their toughness. They start out as stem cells. And you can see an example of a stem cell in the lower right here. Let's pause for a second and say what a stem cell is in general. Not just these stem cells, but any stem cell is so called because of what? I'm sure you've heard about stem cells, but what actually makes a cell a stem cell? Not necessarily every, it depends on whether it's pluripotent or totipotent. But yes, stem cells are cells that are able to produce any of multiple different kinds of cells, which is not the usual case in an adult, right? If you want a new certain kind of cell, then you need to go to that same kind of cell and have it divide into two to have another type of that cell. But if it's a stem cell we're talking about, when it divides, one cell will basically hang around and become the stem cell to replace the one that was lost when the original one divided. But the other one then can develop into any of at least two different types of cells. That's what makes it a stem cell. And embryonic stem cells, by the way, were such an issue because they're so valuable to science because when you get them that early in development at the embryonic stage, they are totipotent, which means they're able to develop into any kind of cell in the body. Whereas further on in development, stem cells become only pluripotent, which means they can become multiple types of cells, but not just any kind. Anyway, there are stem cells at the basal layer of the epidermis whose job it is to just become either of two major kinds of cells, keratinocytes being one of them. And that's by far most of your cells in the epidermis. But for every, whatever the big number is of keratinocytes, there is going to be a melanocyte that's created as well. That's the brownish one on the bottom, middle. They both come from stem cells, and that's what makes it a stem cell. It's able to become either a melanocyte or a keratinocyte. Now, melanocytes are named for the fact that they are able to produce melanin, which is a pigment. There are actually different kinds of melanin, but they're both pigments. And so this is an important but not the only component of skin color. Skin color is also due to how much blood is flowing through it at the moment, for instance, the quality of the blood, and so on. There's all kinds of things that give skin its overall color. But melanin is what chiefly gives it its degree of brownness, which is a continuum, right, in the population. There's everything from very dark to very light skinned. That's mostly due to melanin. Well, the melanin that gives us our visible skin color is inside of keratinocytes. And that's where it does its job, by the way. A pigment in general in science is any material that is able to absorb photons. A photon that gets absorbed by a pigment ceases to exist. That light photon is destroyed in that process. The energy is not destroyed, of course, but the photon itself is. Ultraviolet photons are the things that can damage DNA, and therefore they cause cancer, because damaged DNA is what cancer is all about. And that's why you become more and more likely throughout your lifetime to develop cancer, because you've done an increasing amount of damage over those years to your DNA. The melanin molecules, being pigments, can absorb photons that otherwise would damage the DNA in the nucleus of a keratinocyte. So they act like little parasols. And they, I mean, literally like little parasols, because they're not just evenly distributed throughout the cytoplasm of a keratinocyte. These melanin molecules will huddle together in little clusters, just like a parasol, on only the sunny side of just the nucleus, and not in the rest of the cell. It doesn't care whether the UV falls on it or not, because it's the DNA is in the nucleus. So it forms a little parasol on one side where the sun's coming from, and therefore absorbs those photons so that they can't damage the DNA. That's happening in the keratinocytes, which is the vast majority of the cells, but the keratinocytes don't produce the melanin. Melanocytes do. Okay? And melanocytes gets even more exaggerated than what you see right here, but a melanocyte will have, it'll start producing little granules of melanin molecules, which are the little brown dots in that cell. And these little arms that it's producing, extensions of its overall cell, those become very long, like little tentacles. And eventually pieces of them break off, so they're no longer part of the melanocyte. But each little piece of cell process, and process here doesn't mean a set of steps. Process means something that sticks out or processes. So a cell process is something that processes from the cell, sticks out from the main part. These little arm-like structures are cell processes. When they break off, they are carrying little granules of melanin. And then the keratinocytes that are nearby will phagocytize the little remnants of melanocyte arms. And that's how the that's how the melanin molecules get into the keratinocytes, by phagocytosis. Okay, so they don't produce their own melanin, but they're the cells in which the melanin does its job. And by the way, all humans have about the same number of melanocytes, with the same ratio of melanocytes to keratinocytes. So you might have been guessing, for instance, that a darker colored individual would have a greater population of melanocytes compared to keratinocytes, which would explain the darkness of the skin, but that's actually not what happens. We all have about the same ratio of melanocytes to keratinocytes, but in darker skinned individuals, those melanocytes that are there produce more melanin, and that melanin is more stable and hangs around longer. So we see it in greater abundance in the overall skin when we view the skin. Okay, so those are the two major kinds of skin cells. But scattered in this epidermis, we also have in blue, notice, a tactile cell. Now that is a cell that is going to be operating for sense. The sense of touch is called taction, T-A-C-T-I-O-N. And so there's all kinds of different sensory receptors for different kinds of sensations, like vibration, just being touched very strongly. There's different receptors to do the job. Most of those receptors are in the dermis, like we looked at in the previous picture. But these tactile cells are actually in the population of epidermal cells. All right, so that's the blue one. And then the dendritic cell in green is, strictly speaking, not a skin cell, even though it is part of the epidermis, officially, at least now. It is a cell of the immune system. And by the way, the immune system, despite its name, is not an official organ system. The immune system is a collection of structures scattered throughout all the other organ systems that, in one way or another, help for the process of immunity. Well, there are stem cells in your marrow of your bones, and this is where all blood cells come from. They're stem cells because they're qualified as stem cells because they can produce any of the various kinds of blood cells, of which there are two major components, red and white blood cells, right? All red cells are the same for an individual, but there are different kinds of white blood cells. One of those kinds of white cells become these dendritic cells. They migrate to the epidermis after they mature, and they help out in recognizing potentially harmful invaders and then signaling to the rest of the immune system to do something about it, to kill them in one way or another. They're called dendritic because dendro means branch. And so they have these cell processes as well. And for the same reason, this looks kind of like the cell body of a neuron, in case you ever looked at a neuron, right? The axon is the long thing that comes from this main part of the body. But those, all these little extensions are called dendrites on a neuron for the same reason. They're little tree-like branches. Okay, so those are the major players as far as cell types are concerned, but let's return to the layers now. The most basal layer, the one that's right up against the dermis itself, is the stratum basale. And that's where new skin cells get created by mitosis. Stem cells undergo mitosis, and then, like I said, one of those cells will remain behind, become the new stem cell. The other one will, be, in most cases, become a keratinocyte, in some cases become a melanocyte, depending on what happens. So these are fully alive cells. They're cuboidal to even columnar in shape. But remember that when we classify an epithelium, we don't care about the shape of cells in the basal layer. We care about it only in the apical layer, right? Well, how do you classify epidermis? What kind of epithelium is it? Well, how many layers of cells are there? One or more than one? Therefore, it's what kind of epithelium? Stratified. And more specifically, it is stratified squamous epithelium, because if you look at the shape of the cells in the apical layer, which is the only layer that counts when you're doing this classification, they are flattened. The overall epidermis is considered to be a stratified squamous epithelium, but the cells that are still alive, the ones that are being created by cell division in the stratum basale, those are usually either cuboidal or even a little columnar, so just, in a sense, the opposite of squamous. These are just brand new cells, and they're going to mature, of course. But as they mature, they're going to be displaced by even younger cells being produced where they were produced. And therefore, it's going to push them along their way to the next layer, the next superficial layer, after stratum basale, which is stratum spinosum. And in the stratum spinosum layer or stratum, these cells start producing keratin, which is why they get the name keratinocytes. All right. They also start the process of phagocytosis of the arms of the melanocytes, like I already discussed. Now, stratum basale is named because it's at the base. That's what basale is referring to. Stratum spinosum is, its name makes sense, but not really in living tissue. Spinosum refers to the fact that these cells have a spiny appearance. They look like little stars, but not when they're alive, not in an intact specimen. As part of the preparation of microscopic slides, in order to visualize them, they have to treat them with various things, and that treatment basically dries the cells out, and they would all shrink if they weren't connected to each other. So they try to shrink, but they're all connected to each other by desmosomes, which is what makes the skin a nice barrier that holds these cells together. And so when the cells are shrinking from each other, they're still connected to each other at these desmosomes, and that makes that part of the cell stick out. It makes it look like a spine or a point. So that's why they're called that, but in healthy skin, they're not spiny. They don't have a spiny appearance at all. That's just the name for the next layer. Okay, stratum granulosum is the next one. And so by then, these cells have produced a bunch of keratin, and they are forming granules, which is why this layer is called the stratum granulosum. And in addition to these keratin granules, actually specifically it's keratohyalin granules, but that includes keratin. In addition to forming those, the cells in the stratum granulosum are producing a secretory product that's very rich in lipids, and that gets released from the cells into the interstitium, the spaces between the cells. And so this gives the overall epidermis kind of a bricks and mortar structure, where the bricks are tough cells because of the keratin. The cells are the bricks, in other words. But they are cemented together, or their spaces are sealed by this mixture of lipids that gets secreted from the cells of from the keratinocytes in this layer. And that is really important to the waterproofing aspect of the skin. Skin is not impervious to all things. Things do get through the skin, and that's why certain drugs are able to be given in the form of a patch, for instance. It can actually go through the skin. But many things aren't able to easily go through the skin, including water, which is why you can sit in a pool and your cells of your body don't explode by lysis, as I described when we were talking about hypotonicity, right? Because the pool is certainly hypotonic compared to your cells. But your barrier is pretty waterproof. Now, by this time, when we get to the stratum granulosum, there's enough distance between the blood supply down in the dermis and these cells of the stratum granulosum that diffusion isn't going to do the trick anymore. And so these cells undergo apoptosis, which is cell death, programmed cell death. By the way, it's often mispronounced in because it's spelled differently. A-P-O-P-T-O-S-I-S. Apoptosis. So you might here and there, you might have a cell in the stratum granulosum that's still alive, but it's not going to be alive very much longer. And also, it's undergoing further changes, even after death, that will make the cell even more have a more tough exterior. So the cells are becoming cornified. Corn and horn really mean the same thing. They both mean a very hard structure. So even though these cells are keratinocytes, because they're keratinized cells of the skin, eventually when they reach the superficial most layer and they are the hardest they're ever going to be, some books will call them corneocytes because they've cornified. All right. Now the next one is stratum lucidum. And like I said, you would not have that at all in thin skin, which is most of your skin. It's called lucidum, though, because that means clear. Right? If someone calls me a lucid speaker, that means I speak clearly. Well, lucid means transparent to light as well. And that's because when you look at these things in microscopic preparation, if you're looking at thick skin and you see that layer, there's not really anything there to characterize it in terms of structure. It just looks clear. So it's called the stratum lucidum. But only in thick skin. Otherwise, if it's thin skin, you go straight from granulosum to stratum corneum, which is named for the fact that the cells in this outermost region or most superficial region are cornified. They are hardened. So much tougher than the run-of-the-mill cell, and they're fully dead by this point. And they're the number of layers that you have in each of these, I mean the number of cells that are in each of these layers, can depend where you are on the body. Not just for thick and thin skin reasons, but it depends on the experience as well. If you have prolonged or repeated trauma to one part of the skin, it will respond by becoming thicker. Right? You form a callus, for instance, or a corn. That's just hardened additional layers of skin to protect it from what it is thinking is going to be probably more abuse coming in the future. All right, those are the strata. Now, exfoliation, by the way, is just the process of cells leaving the stratum corneum and therefore leaving your body and becoming dust on your mantle, for instance. A big fraction of the dust in your house is really just dead skin cells because we lose so many continuously. Cells are lost from the stratum corneum and they're produced in the stratum basale to replace them, and in normal skin, the rate of production at the stratum basale roughly equals the rate of loss at the stratum corneum, so your skin thickness remains the same over time. Let's go to three. This is a close-up of where the dermis meets the epidermis, and so each of those major blue hills there is a dermal papilla. And so the overall dermis, which is itself one layer of skin, can be thought of as multi-layered as well. In the epidermis, we have four or five layers, depending on whether it's thin or thick skin. In the dermis, there's two major layers of dermis. And those are called the papillary layer, which is, of course, named for the fact that it includes all of these dermal papillae and just a little bit of dermis deep to that. And then the reticular layer, which is most of the thickness of the overall dermis. So we see a sampling to the right of each of these. In the papillary layer, notice that the connective tissue that makes up papillary dermis is looser. What does looseness refer to? How close what are? Not cells. There aren't all that many cells in this. Is connective tissue. Fibers, right. Loose versus dense, those are opposites in this sense. Refers to not all that many fibers for loose and a big concentration of fibers in dense. Well, papillary dermis is much more loose and therefore easier to get through if you are something that's trying to get through the thickness of that. Which is what we see here. There's a bunch of cells that are parts of the immune system that have left the bloodstream and are trying to migrate through the looseness of the dermal papillae. kind of see that as white debris-looking stuff, but that's actually cells trying to migrate. Whereas in the reticular layer, we have a much higher density of fibers. And why do you suppose it's called reticular? What does reticular mean as a word?
Branchy.
Branchy, or I might say branched. There's extensive branching, which makes sense in the... this gives the overall dermis omnidirectionality with respect to the way it deals with forces. Right? The dermis is not going to get tugged on in only one direction, like a tendon does. Tendon always gets tugged on by the same direction because the muscle can only pull in that direction. But skin gets pulled by all kinds of forces in all kinds of directions. And therefore, you don't see a regular arrangement to these fibers. You have a omnidirectionality. That's the two layers of the dermis itself. So, 4, as usual, is not something I'm going to read to you. I just included it as maybe a study aid. This is really the stuff that we've already talked about to this point. In 5, we're looking at slices of epidermis from two people that differ in their darkness of their skin. And this is what I was already talking about. It's not because the darker skinned individual on the left has more melanocytes. It's just that those melanocytes produce a lot more melanin, and therefore when the keratinocytes engulfed by phagocytosis, those little pieces of what formerly was melanocyte housing the melanin molecules, each keratinocyte will therefore be more highly melanized, house a greater number of molecules, and therefore it makes an even better shade for the nucleus. Probably a good time to make a break because it's kind of a fundamental change in subject to go to hair. So let's stop. Pick up your answer forms if you haven't yet.